possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Coming up in the interview this afternoon, the mystery of our sense of smell. We'll hear about a man journalist Chandler Burr calls the Emperor of Scent. I spoke with Chandler Burr about the Emperor of Scent a year ago. This afternoon, we rebroadcast the interview. That's next. Stay tuned. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. The nose knows, but how does it know? Today on the program, we'll hear about a man who can distinguish the components of just about any smell. Writer Chandler Burr calls him the Emperor of Scent. His name is Luca Turin. He is a man interested in many things, one of them, the mystery of our sense of smell. When something interests Luca Turin, he dives in. He becomes a man obsessed. He told Chandler Burr his obsession with smell began when he was a child in Europe. He began collecting perfume. He was raised in France. He told Burr, France is a country of smells. Turin inhales perfume, then while exhaling, describes it in exquisite metaphor. Here's an excerpt of a review he wrote of the perfume Rive Gauche. Thanks to Rive Gauche, mortals can at last know the scent of the goddess Diana's bath soap, a true emblem of the 70s. This perfume belongs to the uncrowded category of sculpture perfumes. Its seamless, silvery form, initially hidden by white, powdery notes, soon pierces the clouds and gains height by the hour. Chandler Burr, our guest this afternoon, has written for many publications, including The Atlantic, The New York Times Magazine, and The Washington Post. He's also the author of A Separate Creation, A Search for the Biological Origins of Sexual Orientation. His new book, The Emperor of Scent, A Story of Perfume, Obsession, and the Last Mystery of the Senses, is published by Random House. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. Join the conversation. Your questions and comments are invited. You can join us by telephone. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Chandler Burr, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Had you ever met anyone like Luca Turin before?
Never. Absolutely never. And I sort of never thought to. He is Argentine, Italian, French, Swiss. He lives in London with his German wife, and he's lived for a long time in the United States, and his English actually is completely fluent and completely American. He truly is sort of a person from everywhere and nowhere. And I met him completely by chance in the Gare du Nord train station in Paris. Mm-hmm. Because the train was late. We started discussing the last scene in Mission Impossible 1 where Tom Cruise flies the helicopter into the tunnel. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah.
And he explained to me in detail of the physics why that was impossible. And I said, well, because of the lift and the air pressure and the rotors and this sort of thing. I said, well, you know a lot about physics. And he said, I'm a biophysicist. And I said, well, that's interesting. What do you do? I'm a science journalist. He said, oh, well, I do smell. And we didn't stop talking to Waterloo. And when we got to Waterloo, I said, I want to write a book on you.
Mm. Brilliant, eccentric. One of the ways in which you describe him is an egalitarian with elitist tastes.
Yes.
How else would you describe him for our listeners?
Well, it's funny. He's certainly outsized. He is brilliant. One of the stories that has specifically to do with smell that I thought was very interesting, his mother told me, and she lives in Paris, has for a long time. She's Italian origin, lived in Argentina most of her life before she came back to Europe in her mid-20s. She's a very interesting character in herself, and she said that one of the things that, I guess, freaked her out, she and her husband, was they had rented a house in the south of France in the Côte d'Azur when Luca was, I think, 4 or 5. And the kid had never basically been out of Paris, and he was a city kid, and they took him, and they stopped the car at this house, and he got out of the car, and he immediately sort of exploded into motion and started running around and babbling things. And it suddenly occurred to him, to them, that what he was doing was going around and systematically analyzing the smells of every single new thing that he'd never smelled before.
Amazing.
He has an incredibly evolved sense of what is culinarily acceptable and not. He knows everything about wines that you could possibly imagine. He has had conversations before me with experts in the Napoleonic Code, where the experts would then sort of come away saying, my God, you know, he knows everything. One of the things I described was a trip that we took to India. He diagnosed a woman's syphilis from her, simply from seeing her face. And I said, why? And he went into all the medical literature on it and the historical literature.
Hmm. As you say, he picks up information like flypaper.
Yes.
Yeah. He has this amazing gift for metaphor. There's a scene in the book where he's opening vials of single molecules and offering you his descriptions of them.
Right.
Oxane, and it's sweaty mango. Do you have a favorite Turin metaphor, and what explains his gift in that direction?
One of the things that he says that I think is very interesting is that his nose is, and he's very insistent about this, by the way, and I've actually seen him get almost upset with people when they'll say, oh, your nose is, you know, you have such a better sense of smell than the rest of us. And he says, I do not have any, my sense of smell is exactly the same as everybody's. What is developed, and the gift that I have, and I don't know why I have it, but I do, is taking what I smell and putting it into concrete language. He says, what we lack is a language for smell. And I think that that's right. I think that that's what's so brilliant about him. And one of the things that he said, and I'll actually read this to you, is from the book. He said, my father always said, if you translate a proverb from one language into another, you pass for a poet. The same for science. Work strictly within one area and has diminishing returns, but translate a concept from its field for use where it is unknown and it is always fresh and powerful. And he said, the rate-limiting step in this is your willingness to continuously translate, to force strange languages to be yours, to live in between, to be everywhere and nowhere. His linguistic ability, I think, is what's amazing.
Yeah. You know, at that point in the book, I was reminded of another film. We mentioned Mission Impossible, but I thought of Il Postino.
Really?
Yes, because in that book we have the postman striking up a friendship with the poet, Pablo Neruda,
right,
and the power of metaphore.
You know, it's something that I guess that's actually, I would never have thought of it, and yet that works perfectly. And the reason that it does is because it does something that Luca talks about a lot. Perfume, his great obsession, is the highest art form that speaks to the sense of smell. Cuisine is the highest art form that speaks to the sense of taste. Art, you could say, painting, perhaps, is the highest art form that speaks to the sense of vision, and so on. I guess Neruda would speak to our sense of consciousness, and it ties in all the senses. So absolutely, in that sense, I see exactly why you say that.
Mm. But, you know, here we have, I mean, his metaphors are just amazing. And when, you know, there are many perfumes mentioned in this book that I have never encountered, but now I'm dying to get out there. But but I do know Rive Gauche because I had an aunt who wore this.
Oh, really?
And
see, I was wondering why you chose Rive Gauche to read. I was going to ask you that.
He nails it. He nails it.
Yeah. One of the things was, you asked me a second ago about my favorite metaphor. I mean, I worked with these. I mean, I've been writing this for 4 years now and talking to him and all that sort of thing. I think that one of the most amazing metaphors he has is in his review of Gucci Rush. And it's a long paragraph, but the very last three sentences are this. The charm of this perfume is entirely man-made, no mention of nature, for example, flowers and so on. This thing smells like a person. To be exact, thanks to the milky lactone note, it smells like an infant's breath mixed with his mother's hairspray. What Rush can do, as all great art does, is create a yearning, then fill it with false memories of an invented past.
Hmm.
I love that.
And there are other pieces that you quote from the guide that he wrote, or the collection of reviews of perfumes. And this is very interesting to me. He gives scents stars. You know, he rates them 57 for her, 1 star, which, mm-hmm. you know, must be a stinker.
He hated it.
And Paradox, 5 stars, although he says it's not his type.
Right.
But he says it's a heartbreaker.
Yeah. I thought that was interesting. He said one of the properties of loveliness is that it disarms all attempts to be serious and turns all critical machinery into a pile of whirring junk. I'm reading from the review there, but that's actually the example of, and this was long before I had started knowing, even long before I knew he even wrote perfume reviews, by the way. You have to understand that this book started out as one thing, and it became a completely different book. That which was an interesting process in itself. But he cited Paradox to me as the perfume that sort of transcended, if you will, any attempt to analyze it. He does, but his analysis is, I mean, it's different from all of his others. One of the things that's interesting about him, by the way, is he does not classify perfumes in these tired old categories of, oh, this is a woody, this is an oriental, this is a spicy, that kind of thing. And he doesn't even use adjectives. He uses nouns. That's, I think, what's so brilliant about this.
Yeah. Has he changed your view of scent and smell? Have you been living more intensely with the scents now?
It's not a sense that I ever thought about. I actually had. I grew up in Washington D.C. and I, my parents had a friend named Thierry, and Thierry had this. She was an immigrant French woman who had set up a French perfumery in Georgetown, and I sort of used to sell perfume in high school at Christmas to make a little extra cash. I never really thought about it. And I can tell you that being around perfumes sort of did nothing. I knew them. I knew that I loved Vivre. And I knew that I loved a perfume by Molineux called Quartz, which is just wonderful. But I had never really thought about them, and I didn't analyze them. And yes, you know, I knew that Quartz's wonderful smell came from orange blossoms. Well, okay, fine. He made me see perfume. He made me see smell. And I came out of this, and I hope that every person who reads the book will have the same experience. When I finished this project, I realized that it was as if I had been blind my entire life, and I was suddenly able to see. I walk down the street, I walk into a room, I open a book or a gift, and there is another dimension there that was never there before.
Mm. Well, I've been thinking about this now intensely for the last, I don't know, many hours.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it is so fascinating. For one thing, smell has to be incredibly important to us and our sense of well-being and who we are and how we operate in the world.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, we're not paying any attention to it. And I had to think, what kinds of smells do I really hate?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And one of them, burning coffee. But, you know, I never, you just kind of go on. You,
right.
you take note of something and go on. You don't really think about it. And I think that this book is really a wonderful read and just so much fun and so thought-provoking.
Yeah, I asked Hearn once, thank you very much, by the way, I asked Hearn once exactly that, sort of about that issue. You know, there are things that you hate, like the smell of burning coffee. I asked him, are there things that you hate, you who are so sensitive to smells, who are so, and it doesn't mean sensitive in any sort of prissy sense of curling up his nose, this kind of thing, sensitive in understanding them and seeking them out and appreciating them. And I said, does it make you even more averse to? Does it make you hate bad smells even more? And he said, no. He said, in a really weird way, he said, you know, I think I even love bad smells more. He said, basically, I'm like a dog. You know, dogs just love. And literally, he said, you know what it is? It's just more information. It's more beauty. It's more interest. It's more dimension. And he said, I smell these things. And he said, I can smell really foul odors. By the way, you remember the, I mean, I'll say this for the listeners, the smell he says is absolutely the worst he's ever
yes.
smelled. Molecules called nitriles and dead octopus,
rotting yeah. octopus.
Isn't that hilarious?
Yeah.
He said that's absolutely the worst smell. And he said, even that, he'll smell it, and he'll just, it will make your body sort of curl up, and yet, you'll be thinking, my God, this is interesting.
Yeah. The other thing in that portion of the book, he waxed rhapsodically for you about cheeses, and how, you know, that is so cultural.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. When he says, yeah, there's this wonderful thing, I was asking him about that, because I think that we had actually, I've been spending the past 2 years in living in Paris, and just came back to New York a couple months ago, and there's a big store there called the Bon Marché, and they have a huge eating section, and it's very, food shopping section is very expensive and this sort of thing. And you go through them, they have all the French cheeses you could possibly imagine. You really, it really is just, you know, you'll stand there and you'll ask, could I smell this one? Could I try that one? And it really is taking a tour, an olfactory tour of France, but it's a pretty severe one. And he said, you know, this, you have to be trained in this. He said, you will get Americans who come through and they'll think, my God, this stuff is just, you know. And he said, the Japanese will think, I must now commit suicide. And the French will think, quite literally, where's the bread?
Yeah.
Now, that's got to be trained. And that's not nature, that's nurture.
Yeah. But nature is also involved. Both things are involved.
Absolutely.
Here.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I love the way he talks about his father in this section of the book, too. Completely crazy about a particular cheese. He say it was like the entire Grand Army taking off its boots after a 30-mile march in August.
I know, I love that. And it is, too, by the way. You're talking about Sumatra, and it really, really is.
Yeah. You know, he says that, you know, smell, though, makes us, including scientists, nervous.
Mm-hmm.
And he says Americans are particularly squeamish.
Yeah, I think that we are. I have to say, I mean, the Japanese are, the Scandinavians are, and that's cultural. We really sort of believe that, I can't say it on the radio, but, you know, defecation shouldn't stink. And he doesn't agree with that. One of the wonderful things that he said was, you know, I'm from France, and France is a country of smells. I'm looking for this. He said, Frenchmen will smell things that Anglo-men won't. The idea that things should be slightly dirty, overripe, slightly fecal is everywhere in France. And he told me about a guy named Guy Robert, who's about 70. He's a third-generation perfumer. And Guy said to him one time, est-ce que vous avez senti some molecule or other? Have you smelled some molecule? And Turin said, no, he'd never smelled it. What did it smell like? And Robert considered this gravely, and he said, ça sent la femme qui se néglige. It smells of the woman who neglects herself. And out of Robert's mouth, that was the highest accolade he could give a smell. It was the most interesting, pungent, evocative smell you can imagine.
Mm. When and how did he begin collecting perfume?
He began after this sort of weird obsession, which, as I said, sort of made all the adults in his life uneasy. He began formally collecting it when he had gotten his PhD in biology, marine biology specifically, and he moved to the south of France, the Côte d'Azur, to a place called Villefranche, which is right in between Nice and Monaco. And he would go out with a friend of his in this ancient 1956 Peugeot 203 or whatever it was, and they would sort of bop around the countryside and play classical music, and they'd go into these little towns that that everybody visits in the Côte d'Azur, and they'd look for the perfumery, and they would just buy these things that he'd heard about, but that he'd never smelled. And he essentially drained every single thing out of his salary that he possibly could, and he paid whatever they demanded.
Mm. And he met some characters along the way.
He met this wonderful woman I'll say her real name. The Random House, all lawyers made me give her a pseudonym, but I don't care. She can sue me. She's 140 now. She's still alive. This woman named Madame Ricou, and he turned and said to me that her dress and her makeup made her most closely resemble a prostitute. And she would have this bizarre, and if you've ever spent any time in France, actually, it seems less bizarre. It seems pretty much normal. But, you know, from a commercial point of view, she had this bizarre attitude toward her customers, which was she had the sense they were making the pilgrimage to her, and she would sell them what they wanted. And, for example, she would glare at him. And he would say, well, you know, I'd like to buy something, and maybe côté chypre or something. And she'd say, I don't have any. And he'd be looking at the chypre, you know, there'd be bottles of it behind her, and he'd point at it, and he'd say, right there. And she'd turn and look at it, and she'd turn back like a viper, and she'd say, ce n'est pas à vendre, it's not for sale. And it was only when, in sort of a, in a sphinx-like moment, she said to him, "What's the principal ingredient in Bologia?" And he said, "Carnation." And she said, "Fine." And she reached her claw down into her counter, and she brought out a one-ounce tester, mind you, of real pre-war Diorama. And she sold it to him.
You know, before reading this book, I had no idea that some fragrances are changed but continue to carry the same name, as you mentioned, pre-war Diorama.
Right. That is not something that you are supposed to say in public. And to be perfectly frank, if you say it loud enough, specifically enough, you may find yourself with a lawsuit from Dior, Chanel, or this sort of thing. Now, you and I are not at risk at this point, although Random House's lawyers were sort of concerned about it. I had to modify several things in the book from what I wanted to put. Here's the deep, dark secret of perfumery. There are wonderful, classic, great, brilliant fragrances that are created. And they go in the market, and people buy them because they're so wonderful. And they are then inflected, as Turn would say, which is to say, in more blunt speech, they're cheapened. They have to make money on them. You have things that are just unbelievably, phenomenally expensive. For example, a perfumer friend of mine who's a genius, a guy named Francis Cordion, who actually created several perfumes for several of the best-known perfumes for the French designers. He created Le Male for Gaultier, for example. He wanted to use Florence iris root butter. This stuff is $60,000 a pound. $60,000 a kilo. And it's just, you know, you can't put this stuff in a perfume unless, as Turn says, you are terminally insane. And yet, people do. It makes the perfumes wonderful. And then what they do is they'll take out the iris root butter and they'll put in a molecule, maybe a natural, maybe a synthetic, that smells almost like it, but not quite. And maybe people will notice, and maybe they won't notice, and then another year will go by, and of course the profits will go up. And then they'll take out something else. And the two houses that he names, I can name these because, you know, we vetted them and we've taken the risk. The two houses he named, unfortunately, are Dior and Nina Ricci. And he said Dior is the owner of some of the great, great perfumes that were ever created. But he said they have their formulas redrawn by accountants. And from an accounting point of view, it simply doesn't make sense to put these fabulous ingredients in when you can get a molecule that is almost the same. But, as Turn points out, the perfume is then almost the same.
Yeah. Another story involving another aunt here. In the book, there is mention of a scent called Cabochard.
Mm-hmm.
And the perfumer is Greece, I believe. And when I was little, my aunt wore this, but she said she couldn't wear it all the time.
Oh, really?
And she also said, you know, she would put it away. And one day she gave me this bottle of this perfume. And it was, at the time, it was too much for me. I was quite young, and so I put it away. And then
I've never smelled it, actually.
Oh, it was very nice. Except, you know what? I think that may have changed. And what I was wondering, well, there are a number of interesting things here, I think. Number one, my aunt seemed to be saying that her body chemistry changed, and so from time to time she would switch perfumes.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I put that perfume away, and I wondered, you know, had it changed? This was the perfume. Had it changed over the time that it sat in the back of the drawer?
Mm-hmm.
Or have I, you know, since then, since that has now all gone away, and then have run across it again in a department store and tried it on, and it wasn't the same.
Yeah.
And I just wondered, well, what's at work here?
Look, it could be a function of your
memory.
Yeah. It absolutely could be. Having said that, I've been buying quartz for my mom. You know, I'm almost 40 now, and I've been buying quartz for her since I was, gosh, I guess 17. I don't think it's changed at all. It's still as light and lovely and fresh and floral as it ever was, as far as I can remember. I have known people who have had an experience like the one that you had where the perfume changed. The two things that you have to know is the best place to store the two things that damage perfume are heat and light. In particular, by the way, light, believe it or not, almost more than heat. The best place to store your perfumes is in the refrigerator, certainly. But, you know, it makes them pretty inaccessible. If you have it on your dresser for, or in your purse for, you know, 6 months, a year, it's not going to matter. Longer than that, you're probably going to get a difference. There's a wonderful story that Turin told me about being in Moscow, and of course he went to Moscow because of his science, but he continued his perfume collection there, and he would go around. He'd go to all these stores and all these flea markets and this sort of thing, and he would come upon these treasures. And he came upon a perfume made by Houbigant, and I'm forgetting the name of the perfume right now, but Houbigant was one of the great, great perfumers. And of course, the famous legend of Houbigant is that it was because of an Houbigant perfume that they found, I believe it was Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette, because she got out of the carriage and they were dressed, disguised as normal citizens, and she sort of steps down and she's just covered in this gorgeous, gorgeous scent, and they got her right away.
Yeah.
No normal person would have that. So he finds this Houbigant perfume, and it is literally in the depths of this Moscow store. It's never been opened. It's in its original packaging. And with trembling hands, he takes it to the woman. He says, "You know, how much do you want for this?" And she looks at it, and she says, $100. And he buys it. And he says, you know, it was probably worth, you know, 10 times that easily. And he gets it home, and he opens it up. And he said, aside from maybe the first couple head notes, which were a little bit tired from the voyage, the thing just exploded out of the bottle. And he said, it was glorious, glorious. And you understand absolutely why Houbigant became such a great house. This is a perfume that was more than 100 years old. It had survived the Russian Revolution, World War I, World War II, Stalin, and it was still there.
Well, Chandler Burr is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with him about his book, The Emperor of Scent, A Story of Perfume, Obsession, and the Last Mystery of the Senses. Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments. The telephone number's in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, how did Turin go from being obsessed with the way things smell and describing those smells to trying to figure out what it is that is happening when we smell something physiologically?
Mm-hmm. The thing that pointed him in that direction was his perfume guide, which he wrote because his friends got so sick of his obsession that they finally said to him, look, write a guide and just be done with it, damn it. And he did, and the thing got picked up. And it sold pretty well in France. It's certainly the best-selling perfume guide that's ever been published. But what really interested him was the reaction from the professional perfumers. They loved it. They hated it. They were obsessed by it. And everybody was wondering, who is this guy? And he was invited into the perfumers' offices. He was invited to come to the laboratories with the perfume chemists. And it was wonderful for him, and everything was going along fine. But he gradually began to realize something. There was a dominant theory that explains how we smell. And I call it shape in the book. And it's based on what everything else is based on, our digestive system, our immune system. We recognize the shape of the molecule. That's where the information is contained. And as he went on, he would realize that they had all these supercomputers doing all this research on this thing, and they were putting out these molecules and spending just millions and millions of dollars on this research of new perfume materials and molecules, and the emperor had no clothes. The theory doesn't really work. It sounds great. People write papers about it, which they publish, and you realize that there are all sorts of exceptions. The deeper he got into it, the more shape started to fall apart. And here's the most interesting part of all. It's not that not only do we not know how smell functions, according to two things, evolution and molecular biology, we shouldn't be able to smell at all. We shouldn't be able to smell. And that's how he got into the whole story of researching this and figuring out how it worked. And that's how he came up with a new theory, which is based on vibration, not on shape, and which, if he is correct, will win him the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, I think is pretty clear, and which will entirely change the way we look at human biology.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that will happen?
I think it will. I really do. I mean, I certainly make the case for it in The Emperor's Scent. It's an idea, it's a concept that is shockingly outrageous. What it says is we actually have a tiny electron machine gun in our noses that shoots electrons at smell molecules and makes them vibrate. And it's from reading those vibrations that we know what the smell is of a rose, mint, a newborn infant.
You say machine gun. I was thinking as I was reading along also a little bit like a gazillion tuning forks.
Right, exactly. That's another way to think about it, yeah. What the machine, these are all metaphors for what happens. The basic way, the most simple way of saying it is let's put you in a grocery store and you are going by the fresh produce and what's a particularly pungent odor in a produce? I think apples. Maybe somebody's selling apples and they cut one open and you inhale and you've got that very particular smell of fresh apple and it goes up in your nose. Those molecules, those are literally molecules of apple that are being thrown off into the air that you're inhaling. The shapists would say that your nose, there are receptors in your nose and the receptors are feeling the shape. But in fact, what Turing says is happening is they go in there and there are electron bonds holding that molecule of apple together. And what this mechanism does that he's posited that's so revolutionary is it will make those bonds vibrate and it will read the way that they vibrate. And if you sit down at a piano and you play, for example, a D major chord, you're making several of those keys vibrate. It's basically doing the exact same thing. So your tuning forks is a perfect analogy.
Mm. Let's talk with a couple of listeners. First, we're going to go to a listener in Lovington on the toll-free line, line 4. Good afternoon.
Hi. I was going to ask you, why do people... Well, I guess it's been a while since you said this. My theory kind of is that your sense of smell maybe is a little... just one... too much information for us, maybe. An old farm boy, and we used to judge all kinds of stuff, and I could usually tell stuff by the smell whether it was good or not, and generally did really well and didn't even have to see stuff we were looking at.
Like, yeah, that's interesting. People comment on that, yeah.
And I could smell some things about people that gave me information about them that wasn't always pleasant, and sometimes I just wonder if it isn't a social thing that we just don't want that much information or don't, it's not a good thing for us to know.
One of the things I have to tell you about, I mean, it sort of brings to mind the issue of pheromones. We've never isolated a human pheromone. The sense of smell is incredibly complex. You know that cats have a sense that we don't, and they have the five senses that we have, plus they have a sixth sense, which operates out of something called the vomeronasal cavity. And we understand what it is on a molecular level, but we don't understand what it is on a conceptual level because literally we don't have the sense. We have a vomeronasal cavity in us, but it is vestigial. It's not functioning. So there's a lot of people who sort of wonder about how much information you can get about people through that. One of the things that the caller said that I think is really interesting is we can smell atoms. If you hold an egg up to your nose, you know that how we say that sulfur smell, strike a match? You're smelling sulfur atoms. You are smelling the atomic makeup of that thing, literally. And the nose is the only thing that we know that can do that.
Isn't sulfur the carrier for a whole lot of things that we can smell?
There's sulfur, there's a whole bunch of bonds, there are hydrogen bonds with other molecules that we can smell, and they smell very particular. There's all sorts of molecules that we can identify just with our sense of smell.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Next, we're going to talk with a listener in Champaign, Line 1. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Hi. I loved your program on the census. I'm fascinated with the vibration idea. My question is there a different smell that people who are approaching death, which is my specialty, I'm a nurse. Anyhow, I'll hang up and listen to your answer off the air. Thank you.
Mm. You mean, does she mean that smells that people, as they're approaching death, that they smell that they otherwise don't smell? Like visions?
I don't know if she meant the person who was dying or...
Yeah, I think that's what she meant. Yeah. There have never been any reports of that. There are certainly reports of people who see visions or hear voices as they're approaching death. I've not heard that associated with the sense of smell, though it wouldn't surprise me at all if that were the case. One of the things that's interesting is there's a guy named Richard Doty who is essentially a smell doctor, and I talked to him at a conference in India that I described in the book, and one of the things that he says that's so interesting is smell is actually, and smell loss and smell dysfunction, by the way, are actually better indicators, better diagnostics of several major diseases that we have than anything else. That is to say, the person loses their sense of smell or it does something. But he says, a little bit bitterly, we don't pay attention to it because, oh, it's only smell. People lose their vision, they lose their hearing. All of a sudden, the doctors are saying this, they're saying that. But smell is actually a very, very good diagnosis of several major medical conditions.
Mm. What is life like for someone who has no sense of smell?
That is a very interesting question. There are two conditions. One is called anosmia, and that's simply not being able to smell. Since your sense of taste is about 98% your sense of smell, it's not fun. It's not painful, but it's not a hell of a lot of fun. You lose a lot of what goes into literally making the world a more a piquant and spicy place. But there is something that's terrible, and that is cacosmia.
Mm.
Cacosmia is a condition where everything that you smell smells bad. And one of the things that I thought was so interesting about Turin, and he sort of happened to mention this, we were in his car driving to, we were in London driving to Paris, and we were going to put the car on the Eurostar. And he said, oh, by the way, did I tell you about this woman who had this, with cacosmia, who I healed? There was a Scottish woman who had this terrible condition, had this for years. Everything that she smelled terrible. Marmalade, perfume, fresh baked bread, and nobody could figure out what it was. And there was a surgeon who was in London who called him in to talk to the woman. And he talked to her and talked to her, and he said, what does this smell like? And from something that she said, he realized that maybe it was a dysfunction of the neural center, epilepsy of the neural center that had control of smell. They put her on anti-epileptics, and in 2 weeks, her sense of smell was perfect.
Hmm. Is there a way to turn off one's sense of smell?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Cut the olfactory nerve. Cuts it dead.
Boy, what a terrible injury that would be.
Yeah.
Unless you had some kind of... It sounds, though, that this disease that makes everything smell vile can be... addressed, but are there other conditions that would make smells really awful?
What's interesting is that this woman, her name is Janet Rippard, I actually talked to her, she's just delightful, she's an old nurse, I think she's about 70 now, she's retired, and she described this, and she said, I think that what was odd for me was that it just sort of snuck up on me, and it was this disease that came in quietly, and she said, so many times as a nurse you don't see that. There are many other cases of cacosmias in the medical literature. Every single one of them was the result of a traumatic head injury.
Mm.
She's the only example that I know of somebody who had this as apparently just as a neurological disease that happened of itself.
Mm. This was interesting to me also, that, and it was so counterintuitive, is that smoking can enhance one sense of smell.
Right.
That is so
counterintuitive.
Off the wall.
Right, I know. Well, I hate smoking, and Turin smoked, and we would have these big battles where he would be smoking, and I would be complaining about it and making him stop and this sort of thing, and then he'd be sneaking out for cigarettes. And he said to me once, we were at this conference, and this woman said, well, of course, smokers don't smell as well as non-smokers. And he said, that's completely incorrect. And the woman just stopped dead, and the whole place sort of turned and looked at him, and he said, there is a, and I can't remember it right now, but there is a, you know how they pack all these, frankly, poisons and toxins and addictive things and cigarettes. And one of them is a molecule that actually makes the molecule in your nose that's meant to break down smell molecules stop. It stops this molecule. There's nothing in the nose to break down odor molecules, and you actually smell them better for the simple reason that they hang out intact longer. So it makes sense that smokers can, in some cases, smell better than non-smokers.
Interesting. Although sometimes they don't smell very good.
Right. They themselves do not smell very good, right?
How do, maybe you would talk with us a little bit about how, what is involved in the creation of a scent, of a perfume?
It's a matter of pure, well, okay, let me stop that. It's a matter of pure imagination and artistic talent and genius, and it's a matter of money. There are those two things. Now, it depends on who you are, what you're doing, and this sort of thing, which amount it is of which. There is a wonderful, I cannot stress this to anybody listening to us right now, a wonderful perfumer who is a guy named Frederic Malle, M-A-L-L-E. He's French, and he, his family has been in the perfume business for hundreds of years. And Frederic Malle went out, and he did something that nobody else has done. He went to six genius perfumers, and he said, I want you to create perfumes. I am not going to tell you anything about what you can or cannot put into it, how expensive it must be, what ingredients you can or cannot use, what the marketing is going to be, what the name has to be. We're not going to do any focus groups. You're going to produce a pure work of art. And I have to tell you, one is a woman, Giacobetti. I can't remember her first name right now. She's Italian. Her perfume is called En Passant, and it is a perfume that came to her as she was walking in a street, I believe in Italy, past a bakery and a flower shop at the same time. And this is one of the most phenomenal fragrances you've ever smelled in your life. He didn't tell her what to do. She just did it. Okay? Now, that's one extreme. Generally, with Calvin Klein or Gucci or Dior or Anna Sui or Donna Karan, there are people at Donna Karan and Calvin Klein and this sort of thing who sort of decide, okay, we want to do a fragrance, we want a masculine, we've done this and that, these perfumes have worked well, they've sold well, they've made a lot of money, let's do one like this. And I don't mean to be too cynical about it. Look, they're producing something that has to sell. But what they'll do is they'll go to one of the big boys, one of the seven very secretive corporations that actually make these molecules. I'll say, okay, here's our brief. We want this to smell like, and then you can get sort of two extremes here. One will be, we want this to smell exactly like this perfume that made $40 million last year. Or you'll get some things that are actually pretty artistic. And one of them, I'm trying to recall this word for word, it was something like, we want the smell of the naked back of a woman with chocolate eyes on a winter's evening in a Chinese palace.
Where the candles are melting.
Where the candles are melting candles. But it's interesting because it actually gives you, you want it, the back of a woman, I think it was. Well, okay, you want it to smell, there's a human smell. There's a very strong human smell.
Mm-hmm.
A Chinese palace, well, that gives you certain orientals and certain spices. A wintry smell, they want it cold. They don't want it hot. All these things communicate. And then what you'll have is you'll have perfumers who will have all these perfumes, all these molecules, all these fragrances at their fingertips, just in the exact same way that a painter will have paints in his palette. And they will say, okay, how can I conceive of this? And they'll simply start putting it together, putting it together, putting it together. And they'll come up with essays, and they'll give it to these people, and they'll finally arrive at the perfume that to them smells like the back of a woman with chocolate eyes in a Chinese palace.
Wow. And something similar is going on at a very, I think it's what you call functional. the functional end of the business. That's the folks that are creating fragrances for soaps and shoe polish,
right,
and you name it.
Right. One of the things you said, I think you said this in the beginning, was something about Turin, how I had commented that Turin was a fierce egalitarian with a very sort of developed aesthetic.
Elitist tastes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. This is, I think, a perfect example of that. He is one of the few people I know who fully appreciates the finest, most expensive, most exotic haute parfum, the fine fragrances, and functional perfumery, literally the stuff that goes in to make Tide smell good. And one of the things that he says, and he truly believes this, is that the functional people are doing some of the best perfumery around. These products are very, very difficult to perfume, to make something new, to make something fresh, to make it interesting. And you're not given a lot of money to do it, by the way. So they really have some constraints. There is, for example, a candle that was made that's called Premier Figuier, First Fig. And he told me, he said, this is one of the most wonderful things around, and it is just functional perfumery. And I went and I smelled it, and it's absolutely sublime. It's mm-hmm. incredible. It's just this huge, big, fresh, wonderful fig.
Mm, that sounds great.
It's wonderful.
Is it available in this country?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Absolutely.
Hmm. You find it at the grocery?
Gosh, they're going to be so upset if I don't come up with the name. It's Premier Figuier. I'm looking at my index right now.
And it's a candle, like a room freshener
candle? It's just
candle?
A candle.
It's just a candle.
Okay. Oh, Diptych. That's it.
Okay.
It's by Diptych.
Okay. Well, we're off on a hunt now.
Yes.
Chandler Burr, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Afternoon.
It's my pleasure.
Chandler Burr has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of The Emperor of Scent, A Story of Perfume, Obsession, and the Last Mystery of the Senses. The book is published by Random House. And that interview with Chandler Burr was conducted on February 11th of 2003. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. Settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade, futures finished in the day in a very interesting fashion all day long, as it's been throughout this 2004 trading year so far. Beans were up about 22 cents in the nearby contracts. We'll get to those numbers in just a bit. The corn finished the day just slightly higher, but the wheat finished lower, down a nickel in the nearby March contract at 383 for the high, a low at 371, and a settlement price there at 375 and a quarter. Once again, the March wheat settling a nickel lower. May futures 389, the high, the low at 377 and a half, and a settlement price at 382 and a quarter, down 4 and a quarter. July futures 382 and a half, high, low at 373, a settlement at 376 and a half. They finished down 3. September wheat futures 385, the high, the low at 377 and a half, and a settlement at 379. They finished 4 lower for the day. December contract 392 and a half, the high, the low, settled the low there at 383 and a settlement price at 387. They finished down 3 for the December wheat. March corn 286 and a half, high, low at 282 and 3 quarters, and a settlement price at 284, up 1 and a half for the day. May futures in the corn pit, noon 293, the high, the low at 289, a settlement price at 290 and a half, up a penny and 3 quarters. In July, 295, the high, the low at 291 and 3 quarters, a settlement at 293 and a quarter. They were up 1 and 3 quarters. September futures for the corn pit, 287 and a half, high, low at 285 and a quarter. A settlement at 286 and a half, up 2 and a quarter. The trading range now for the December, this is your new crop, 284 and three quarters on the high side, the low at 281 and three quarters, fairly narrow trading range, and a settlement price at 283, a penny and three quarters higher for the day. March contract of the 05 corn, 287 and a half high, low at 284 and three quarters. A settlement at 286, up a penny and three quarters. In July, 288 the high, the low at 287 and a half, a settlement price 288. They finished 2 higher. December futures for 05, 258 the high, the low at 257. That 1 cent trading range settled up on the high at 258, up a half cent for the day for the December 05 corn. March oats now 152 and a half the high, the low at 147 and a half. And a settlement price at 149.75. They were up a penny and a quarter. The May futures 156 high, low at 152.75. And a settlement at 154.5, up 2 for the day. From the soy complex, March beans, an 853 high today, breaking back through that magical 850 area, 840 on the low, 851 a settlement price, up 22 cents. May beans, 853 the high, the low at 836, settled 850.5, up 21.75. And the July beans, 836.5 high, low at 821, settled 834.5, up 22. September, 738 the high, the low at 734, settlement price at 735, 10.5 higher there. And the November futures, 666 the high, the low at 659. Your new crop November, 663, a settlement price. They finished 10.25 higher. You might note that that had about half as much gain as the nearby contracts did. January beans, 665 the high, the low at 662, and a settlement at 664. They were up a dime. And the March futures of 05 contracts, 668 in the bean pit for the high, the low at 664. That March 05 beans settled 665. They were up 7 on the day. March bean meal, 258.20 high, low at 249, settlement price at 257.20. They were up 107.01. They were up 107 for the day. And the May bean meal at 257.80 on the high, the low at 249, and a settlement price at 256.90. They finished the day up 117. March bean oil, 32.24 the high, the low at 31.75, a settlement price at 31.90, up 18. And the May bean oil, 32.15 high, low at 31.66, a settlement at 31.81. They finished up 15 for the day. Now here's Celeste with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. March feeder cattle, the high today 85.42.5, the low 84.10, the settlement 84.85, that up 87.5. April 85.70, the high 84.65, the low 84.85, the settlement that up 30. May 86.70, the high 85.65, the low 85.85, the settlement that up 2.5. August feeder cattle, 89 even the high, 88.25 the low, 88.37.5 the settlement, that down 10. February live cattle, 76.95 the high, 76.10 the low, 76.47.5 the settlement, that up 35. March, 74.75 the high, 74.25 the low, 74.25 the settlement, that up 25. April, 73.20 the high, 72.20 the low, 72.37.5 the settlement, that down 25. June, 70.65 the high, 70.05 the low, 70.15 the settlement, that down 12.5. April lean hogs, 59.40 the high, 57.95 the low, 58.60 the settlement, that down 10. May, 59.60 the high, 58.85 the low, 59.30 the settlement, that down 7.5. June lean hogs, 64.05 the high, 62.85 the low, 63.52.5 the settlement, that down 27.5. July, 60.35 the high, 59.50 the low, 60.05 the settlement, that down 30. February bellies, 94.95 the high, 93 even the low, 94.30 the settlement, that down 10. March, 95.20 the high, 93.10 the low, 93.90 the settlement, that down 50. The Dow is currently up 97 points. The NASDAQ is up 29, and the S&P 500 is up 12 points.
Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields.